The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
We have looked at various schools of philosophy through which D'Oyvert himself passed, namely Kantianism and Neo-Kantianism. We looked first of all at the Marburg school of Neo-Kantianism, and now to close off that discussion, we turn for a brief time to the Baden school of Neo-Kantianism, or as it is sometimes called, and as D'Oyvert himself called it, the Southwest German school of Neo-Kantianism. Now, this Baden school of Neo-Kantianism shares the fundamental characteristics of Neo-Kantianism with the Marburg school. It too denies that there is a thing in itself. It too emphasizes the creative, constructive role of spirit. Nevertheless, there are important differences between these two schools. The Baden school does not focus on the natural sciences. It has in view the entire range of human culture, and it is interested in the development of culture. In the Baden school, there is a marked influence of German historicism. Now, within the Baden school, special attention is given to Immanuel Kant's second critique, his critique of practical reason. The first critique was the critique of pure reason, while the Baden school gives attention to the second critique, gives special attention to the second critique, the critique of practical reason. In opposition to the Marburg school, it is ready to admit an irrational element into philosophy. This school, this Baden school, takes axiological laws. It takes the ought as the foundation of objective being. And it says that these axiological laws, these oughts, which are based on values. And so we find that the Baden school is value-oriented. The Baden school agrees with the Marburg school, however, in saying that there is no reality that is transcendent to consciousness in general. Judgments are based on immanent reality. But when these judgments claim that they are true and objected, this is to be attributed to the existence of transcendent values which entail an obligation. According to the Baden school, a judgment is true when it conforms to a transcendent obligation. Now, contrary to the Marburg school, the Baden school does not wish to reduce all being to logical method. We noticed how important logic was to the Marburg school and how that everything could be considered within a logical framework. But according to the Baden school, there are various immanent ideal realms, and each of these has its own laws. The Baden School holds that there are independent values in the spheres of science, logic, morality, aesthetics, and so on. These values do not exist. They are not just there, but they hold for some realm or other. Now, this Baden School distinguishes, in general, three classes of value: the true, the good, or the moral, and the beautiful. And to these, Windelband adds the value religion. Now, these values are supposed to have absolute validity. They are not relative. They have absolute validity. They belong to an unchangeable, eternal kingdom of values in themselves. So, as we have said too, there is place also for the independent value of religion. These religious values are considered to be impossible apart from reference to a transcendent reality. But this God, or this transcendent reality, is not attainable by way of consistent thinking. Faith in God, however, is required by the existence themselves of these religious values. To believe in a transcendent God, we do not have to understand him. But if we know about these religious values, we find that these require the existence of God. Now, this Baden school is especially well known for its theories concerning what are called the human sciences, or the Geisteswissenschaften. One might think of spiritual sciences. Geist in German is spiritual. But generally speaking, one does use the term human sciences, or the Geisteswissenschaften. Heinrich Rickert, who was a member of the Baden school, distinguished between the natural sciences, which are generalizing in character, and the human sciences, which are, as he called them, ideographic and individualizing. The human sciences do not aim to present general laws. Their aim is to describe individual phenomena. For example, history, which would be a human science, is an individualizing science. According to Rickert, the historian investigates individual phenomena. But that does not mean that he may simply investigate just any individuals or any individual phenomena. He must make a selection. And this selection presupposes a judgment of value. Value judgments, this neo-Kantian position says, lie at the foundation of all the human sciences. Now, a major distinction within the Baden school was that between values and reality, and one must take special note of this distinction. The Baden school drew this distinction in a very thoroughgoing way. Very characteristic of it is the distinction between being, in the German sein, and obligation, sollen. Sein and sollen, being on the one hand and obligation on the other hand. And as we progress, we shall observe how interested Doivert was in breaking down this antithesis between reality and value as it was conceived by this school of neo-Kantianism. But now, having looked at Kantianism very briefly and at Neo-Kantianism, both the Marburg School and the Baden School. We turn briefly also to the movement which is called phenomenology. Now, as we have seen, Neo-Kantianism typically regarded the understanding as conceptual. There was no place for what might be called intellectual intuition. Only the understanding, the Neo-Kantians said, had synthetic power. Only the understanding was able to grasp things and draw them together. Among the Neo-Kantians, however, there was at least one person who, under the influence of phenomenology, took exception to this view. His name, at least one of these, was Emil Lask, L-A-S-K. Lask developed a system that had a place for intuitive concepts. But for the most part, the Neo-Kantian made a distinction between concepts and conceptualization and intuition. Now, phenomenology has been called a philosophy of essence. And as we look at this school, we have to keep that term essence in mind. Now, there are two fundamental traits of phenomenology. First, it has a method which consists in a description of the phenomenon, that is, a description of that which is immediately given to awareness, in stark contrast to the position, let us say, of a Hermann Cohen, who developed, as we saw, a panlogism, which was then oriented to the method of the natural sciences. Phenomenology looks away from the natural sciences. It wants to overcome the dominancy of the natural sciences. In opposition also to Kantianism and Neo-Kantianism, it does not regard epistemology, it does not regard the theory of knowledge as being the focal point. Will not rest its attention, it will not focus its attention on the science or the theory of knowledge, but it will look elsewhere. Now, in the second place, it has as its object the viewing of essences. That is, it wants to view the ideal intelligible content of appearances. It wants to view these essences in an immediate intuition, or what is spoken of in German as Wesenschau, an intuition of essence. It vigorously opposes a formalism that it associated with the Kantian position, and it opposes particularly the formalism which it associates with Neo-Kantianism. As we saw, in Neo-Kantianism, content is produced by pure thought. That is, we found this in the Marburg school, that content is produced by pure thought. Neither does it want to see content as being subordinated to rational form. As we saw, Cohen and de Torp would not allow for a content independent of thought. They were even more radical in this regard than Immanuel Kant himself. They rejected Kant's dualism of form and content, thought and experience. And it is this kind of opposition that the phenomenologist also wants to eliminate. Now, the founder of the phenomenological movement in modern philosophy was the philosopher Edmund Husserl. Now, Husserl's effort resembled that of René Descartes, who is often regarded then as the father of modern philosophy. Husserl's effort resembled that of René Descartes. He sought, even as Descartes did, to lift philosophy from its chaotic and unscientific position and to elevate it to the position again of being a first science. That is a foundational science, a basic science, a science that then would be a science that precedes the other sciences and offers them their foundation. He wanted then to elevate philosophy again to the position of being a first science, the foundation for all the theoretical fields. He wished to rescue philosophy from its unscientific character. He wanted to make it again a true science. Now, he desired, furthermore, to find for philosophy the correct starting point, to start off correctly, and for him that meant without any presuppositions whatsoever. He wanted to start out founding philosophy on a precise, on an exact method, without any presuppositions whatsoever. And on this method, mathematics and the exact sciences then furnish the example. Now, Husserl himself began with mathematical studies. He published early on a philosophy of arithmetic. At the turn of the century, he published his famous logical investigation. Now, in the latter work, he criticized the dominant, shall we say, psychologistic point of view of the 19th century. One could also call this point of view a nominalistic one. But I think the thing that will be prominent in our mind is this, that Husserl criticized the dominant psychologistic point of view of the 19th century. A psychologism then would attempt to reduce everything to psychological proportions. I have said at times that our age is thoroughly psychologized, that people look at things from a psychological point of view, looking within themselves at the drama of their feelings, trying to analyze their feelings, be oriented to feeling and to emotion. As I say, our age is thoroughly psychologized. Husserl attempted to criticize this psychologism. He was against a consequence of this psychologism, which delivered everything, including the problem of truth, to the tender mercies of what the Germans call erklärende Psychologie, that is, a psychology that seeks then to found things, to explain things in a causal fashion, to find the cause, the origin, and the causal sense of everything. And Husserl attempted to criticize this erklärende Psychologie, a psychology then that would just look at things in a causal way, which to many means a mechanical way. Now, fundamental to Husserl's method was what he called reduction. Now, in reduction, there is an expression of methodological doubt that one looks at the phenomenon and he attempts to eliminate everything that is not to be used at the outset in making a fundamental beginning. As we saw, of course, Husserl then was desired to find the correct beginning, a beginning without any presuppositions whatsoever. And you would then be able to find the correct beginning by way of this method, which he called reduction. Now, according to this method, all presuppositions, all judgments concerning the existence of something, that something exists, all existing theoretical views, everything that with which you might come of a theoretical character, all existing theoretical views, all existing concepts, all concepts with which one might come to his investigation, and all values, all the values with which one might come to his investigation, all these had to be eliminated if one was going then to start properly, if one was going to come to this beginning. So reduction was a very important instrument for Husserl to come to the origin, to get an original starting point that then could serve as an unprejudiced starting point. Now, in the process of this reduction, Husserl said, there is a reflection on the ego. Now, we have seen reflection entering the picture as we have gone along. We detected an element of reflection in Immanuel Kant's ethical position as he reflected on the ethical self that constituted itself a self by obeying the moral law, by obeying what Kant called the categorical imperative. And we also saw this element of reflection too in Neo-Kantianism. But now we observe that there is a reflection in this process of reduction on the ego, according to Husserl. There's a reflection on consciousness, a consciousness in relation to which the entire world becomes a phenomenon. You have then to think of the ego on the one side, or the self, and then the phenomenon on the other side. And the phenomenon is always related to the ego, in relation to which then the entire world becomes a phenomenon. Now, Husserl's intent was to create a field of pure consciousness in relation to which the world, our thoughts, opinions, values, judgments, etc., would be a phenomenon. Then, after one has developed this field of pure consciousness, the world is brought back again. It is set before one's eyes to be investigated as to its meaning and structure. Now, Husserl claimed that this field of pure phenomena, set over against the pure ego, is that upon which all science rests. It is a field. It is one's life of consciousness, which is open, then. It is open to a purely transcendental consciousness. Now, by taking this route, Husserl wanted to avoid any a priori formalism. Instead of having something enter the picture a priori, or as we put it, before the fact, you eliminate all a priori. You at least think that you have eliminated everything a priori. What you want to do is come, setting, as we said, the ego over against the pure field of phenomena. This field is such as it is set over against the ego, and now one wants then to examine this field, these phenomena, as to their meaning and structure. Now, you see, what he wanted to do then is to bring into the field of consciousness what he thought of as an undivided zone, a pre-theoretical zone, where one would not yet have distinctions as they are characteristic of theoretical thought. One major distinction characteristic of theoretical thought would be that between subject and object. And so Husserl was attempting to undermine, you might say, or to relativize such distinctions as that between subject and object. It was his purpose then to get beyond the individual thing, which then, to which these things might apply, that is, such distinctions might apply, and get to the thing itself, the essence of the thing before one's view. Now, the result of this reduction, as I have suggested, was this Wesensschau, or intuition of essence. A description of what lies at the fundamental starting point, at the basis of the sciences. He wanted a descriptive illumination of everything that we can intend in our consciousness. This word intend needs a little bit of explanation. The idea here is that in our consciousness, we are going out toward things. We are intending them. In our consciousness, we are always related to or going out toward an object. And so he wanted a descriptive illumination of everything that we can intend in our consciousness. In this fashion, one is able to discover the essence of anything within the intentional field of consciousness. Now, a second point then is Husserl's use of this idea of intentionality. As we have seen, he set a pure transcendental consciousness over against a pure field of phenomena. Now, this relationship is dependent upon an intention, upon a going out toward of the consciousness, a self-orientation to the object. Now, following Brentano, the philosopher Brentano, Husserl said that all of our thought, experience, and knowing is intentional. There is, he said, an unbreakable unity, but a polar unity, between the intentional and what is intended, between the intentional and the intentional object, or what he called noesis and noema. Now, the phenomenological reduction, he thought, could proceed with reference to either of these two sides. It could, on the one hand, be involved in creating the pure field of consciousness. We're then not thinking of just this or that or the other consciousness, but we are thinking of gaining the pure consciousness, the pure field of consciousness. We must then use the reduction, or we may use the reduction in order to accomplish this. On the other hand, the reduction was involved in clarifying the phenomenon, ultimately the phenomenon of the world as a whole. Now, as we have seen, Husserl sought to overcome the formalism he associated with the neo-Kantianism that was dominant in his time. He directed his efforts against this formalism. For instance, Immanuel Kant started from a set of a priori forms. We noted that. He started then with a bifurcation between forms of perception and of thought. He had a bifurcation, as we said. There were a priori forms, both of perception and of thought. Now, in Kantianism, as we have seen, the weight falls on consciousness. Now, but for Cohen, as we saw, the criterion of truth is the way that the problems are posed methodologically by consciousness. In fact, what you want to do, of course, is to move from problem, theoretical problem, to theoretical problem. You pose the problems, and the criterion of the truth is the way that these problems are posed methodologically by consciousness. But in Husserl, there is supposed to be such an interconnection between consciousness and the object that the choice of method is different for each phenomenon. One might think of it this way: for the neo-Kantian, the great emphasis falls on the method with which you approach a particular field of study. The way you form your concepts will then have its effect. It will affect the way you approach the field of study. For the phenomenologist, on the other hand, the way you approach things, the concepts you use, are more dependent upon the field which you are investigating. And according to Husserl, for each area of knowledge, a method must be sought anew in an original fashion. You must seek then out your method for each area of knowledge, for each field of investigation. There are no set categories of thought. There is only a constantly varying attitude as one seeks the inner structure of things, as one seeks the inner structure of things noetically. In this method, then, one is at the beck and call of the object to which then his consciousness directs itself. The object. That may be something very exalted, such as the sphere of art or the sphere of jurisprudence, or it might be just as humble as a needle or a thimble. And if we look at some of the writings of those who stand in the phenomenological movement, they will often analyze things that are very common, very commonplace indeed. A thimble, a needle, whatever it may be, a sewing machine, something of the sort. As humble as that, or perhaps as exalted as a sphere of art or the sphere of jurisprudence. So in Husserl, we do find that there is a close connection between man and his consciousness and the world. In fact, they are seen in a polar relationship that is nevertheless a very close one. Now, in Husserl, then, the starting point is not supposed to be in a formal set of categories, but in the world of everyday experiencing, the world of the ordinary. It has been said that phenomenology is a reflection where the thinker investigates his spirit and the world in their constitutional unity, and thus seeks to bring to clarity what is already the state of affairs in one's normal attitude with respect to reality. The idea then is not to change reality here in this theory of knowledge, but to bring to light what then is the state of affairs in reality as that is comes or is appears to our normal attitudes, to our normal everyday run-of-the-mill attitudes. The original given state of affairs, he says, cannot be eliminated by this scientific investigation. It cannot change it, it cannot eliminate it. As we said, it must simply bring it then to light. It then wants to develop a thinking that is clear, that is open to itself, but any scientific investigation depends on this area of everyday experience, which, according to Husserl, underlies the scientific problem, is deeper than the scientific problems which investigate these theoretical, certain theoretical questions. Now, in the third place, Husserl speaks of the horizon of our experience. The intentional object, that object toward which we are always going out toward, that intentional object, as it is first given, is never completely clear. It can act no more than as a transcendental guide for the acting thinker. It must be clarified. It is that which, in the process of this search, retains its own identity and as an object and as a problem. But as we say, at first, it is not completely clarified. And so, we find that in Husserl, we do not have the idea that there is an intuition that is simple, that is completely unproblematic. One is faced with the phenomenon, but there must be this process of clarification. One can reach a clear and full view of the phenomenon only after a long process then of clarification. The phenomenon must be brought to the place where it can reveal itself. Now, if this intentional object, let us say art, law, a thimble, a melody, a sewing machine, if the intentional object is only a preliminary indicator, if it only points the way, it itself comes to clarity only against a particular horizon, against a particular background with which it is structurally connected. It must then appear within that which we might call the proscenium arch, as we have a proscenium arch above a stage. It must come to expression, it must show itself against a particular background within a particular horizon, and in the last analysis, according to Husserl, this horizon is the world in its totality. Now, one becomes conscious of the world as the ultimate horizon. But also, each object, along with the particular intention that accompanies it, has a point of view from which it is seen as its horizon. Each given intentional object has its own possible fullness and completion as an horizon. On the noetic side, no searching and no thinking starts entirely from the beginning. We are always in a particular situation. We are always a consciousness filled with a particular meaning. One aims to come to clear vision, but this clear vision will be found only as a particular horizon is explored. There is also the horizon, the presence of the totality in the not yet completely revealed object. Now, this totality is not clearly given, but it is present in every phenomenon, and it leads us ever onward, it beckons us ever onward to push back the boundaries of our investigation of the object. Now, Husserl believes that thought stands confronted with totalities that are not reducible to their parts. In this regard, of course, he would stand in opposition to a psychological point of view, which would seek then to understand by analyzing the phenomenon, analyzing it in a psychological fashion, trying to reduce it to its components. But Husserl places the idea of totality at the center of his thought. And these totalities then are not reducible to their parts. There is a striving for the clarification of the idea, the essence of the thing, in contrast to an analytic way of thought characteristic of natural science. The Erklären der Psychologie, the psychology that seeks then to explain by way of causal explanation. For a person like Husserl and others, then this method would be characteristic of natural science and an analytic point of view, and Husserl is seeking then to get a more total view. Now, Husserl also points out that there is no opposition of a thing in itself to experience. You can find, of course, in the dualism in Kant, the opposition of our experiencing, which is a sense experiencing, and the thing itself, which we saw was that X, that unknown standing behind our experience. But Husserl wants to overcome this opposition. The phenomenon, for the phenomenologist, is not the phenomenon in the older sense of being that which is only a reflection of reality. Phenomenon is not simply a reflection of reality. The phenomenon is that which appears as it reveals itself to completed analysis. And for the phenomenologist, there is nothing that lurks behind this phenomenon. There is nothing that is an X beyond the phenomenon. And so man is regarded as having a direct access to things. Knowledge is a self-transcending toward the things, going beyond ourselves toward the things. The phenomenon is the thing in itself, but it is always more than the knowledge we ever possess of it. And so we must then constantly be going toward it. We shall then never have a full knowledge of it. Now at this point, what we have done is to look at three philosophies with which Dooyeweerd had to do, or two major directions with which Dooyeweerd had to do, the Kantian direction and the phenomenological direction, because Dooyeweerd tried then to synthesize his own position, his Christian position, with Kantianism, with neo-Kantianism, and then with phenomenology. But as we shall see, Dooyeweerd came to the position that this kind of synthesis was impossible. So at the same time that he had passed through these philosophies, he was particularly interested in criticizing them, but as we have said, as he criticized them, according to his own testimony, he was criticizing himself in his own development. Now we have just about a minute and a half here. Is there any question?
Yes, on Husserl's first point, namely all presuppositions, views, theories, concepts, values that one begins with had to be eliminated, was he saying, in effect, that we essentially experience reality first on an irrational level, and then we conceptualize it?
I doubt that you would want to characterize him saying that we experience it on a rational level and irrational level, and then conceptualize it. I think that would not that would lead to the psychologizing which he was attempting to overcome. Mm-hmm. However, it is the case that if you think of the rational as that which is simply scientific, theoretical, conceptual thinking, then of course what he was looking for was the foundation of that in something deeper. If we call that then irrational, what he would try to do is to reach down into the essence, to intuit the essence, and then see that as the foundation for the rest, in that way, but nevertheless, the only way you can do that is by eliminating all existence statements, all value statements, and attempt to be completely neutral, and Dooyeweerd will criticize this.